The Democratic left crowns Elizabeth their queen. Georgia Republicans say their new Senate nominee is better than none. And the courts send mixed messages on Obamacare. From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 35 of The Political Junkie. We returned from our visit to Alaska with a bunch of questions. What just happened to the Affordable Care Act? Are Kansas Republicans quitting Sam's Club to back a Democrat for governor? Did the stronger candidate come out of the GOP Georgia Senate runoff? And what's the long game for Elizabeth Warren? Fortunately, we have very smart guests on the show this week to tell you what they know. Here's what I know. It's time for this week's trivia question. Michelle Nunn, the daughter of former Senator Sam Nunn, is the Democratic nominee for the Georgia Senate seat being vacated by Saxby Chambliss. Polls show she's a strong candidate, even though she's never run for office before. And that means it's time for another convoluted trivia question. Who is the last daughter of a statewide elected official to be elected to the Senate in her first run for public office? Yep, that's the question. Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll pick a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. And you never have to wait to hear the trivia question. We post the question in plain English on our Facebook page every Wednesday afternoon. And there's some other fun stuff on the page, too. Go check it out. Please. We'll give you the answer to last week's question later in the show. Two different rulings on the Affordable Care Act came out of appeals courts this week. One said the government couldn't subsidize insurance for people on the federal insurance exchange. The other said, subsidies are fine. Which way the courts ultimately go could lead to cutting off financial help for millions of people or increasing the cost of their premiums, making Obamacare unaffordable for many. If Tuesday wasn't dizzying enough, there are other courts weighing the same arguments with different decisions likely to come. So what's the verdict on Obamacare? Good thing we have Julie Rovner in the studio to guide us through this. She's a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, the former health policy correspondent for NPR, and the author of Healthcare Politics and Policy, A through Z. Julie, thank goodness the Affordable Care Act starts with one of those letters you cover in your book, the A part. So welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Listen, I don't know if people realize this, but when we worked together at NPR, your name was right above mine on the staff phone list.
I did not notice that.
No, I think about that all the time. Help me out here. What's going on with the Affordable Care Act?
Well, once again, it seems to be in some peril. I did some work this week. I gave another speech about the legislative history of the Affordable Care Act and realized how many near-death experiences it has had. Well, this apparently is yet another. We've got two appeals courts and basically a lawsuit that was brought by conservative opponents of the law who filed the suit with the attempt to do mischief. And what they said, they pointed out that buried within the voluminous text of this law is a provision that says that subsidies to help people afford insurance are only available to those who are in an exchange, quote, established by the state.
Not the federal government.
Well, that's a question. There's elsewhere in the law, it says that if a state fails to establish an exchange, the federal government will do that for them. And there's a reference to something called such exchange, which a lot of people read that to say, yeah, so now the federal government is standing in the state's stead. And so no matter where you are, you're in an exchange. It says it's your state. Even if the federal government is running it, that's okay. But apparently the literal reading of that line led to this lawsuit. And it's all about, I said this morning, legal scholars talk about statutory construction. I mean, it's basically how you interpret those exact words. And the rules of doing that in court are that you're supposed to, if it's confusing or ambiguous, you're supposed to look beyond that to the entire structure of the law and then beyond that to the legislative history. And basically, the bottom line is that if the way the administration has construed this, and what's really at issue here is this IRS regulation that says subsidies are available in both state and the federal exchanges.
That's the government argument.
Right. Well, no, but that's what's at issue is whether that IRS ruling is regulation is legal, because that's not exactly what the law says. The IRS read the law to say, look, everywhere else it clearly makes it obvious that these subsidies were intended to go to people in all kinds of exchanges. And so that's what they did. What the courts are supposed to do is apply this two-part test. One, to say, what does the law actually say? And if that's ambiguous, they're supposed to give the administration, the agency, the benefit of the doubt if what the agency has created makes sense, basically. And of course, the appeals court in every court that's seen this until Tuesday said that this was a ridiculous lawsuit and that obviously Congress intended to have subsidies available for everyone. And that's, if you read the entire law, it makes it abundantly clear. This three-judge panel in the Washington, D.C. District Court of Appeals read it and they said, no, we don't see that. It's ambiguous. And by the way, we don't see that what the IRS did is even permissible based on what the actual statute says.
So when you heard the D.C. Court decision on Tuesday, you didn't go, oh, my goodness, because basically you expected that court to rule that way and there are other courts ruling other ways.
That's right. It was fairly clear from the oral arguments in the case, which interestingly took place the same day the oral arguments for Hobby Lobby did. So most people were much busier at the Supreme Court that day than were watching this case. But there were a lot of warning signs that this might go this way, that the two of the three judges, very conservative Republicans, were sort of leaning in this direction. So it was not a shock. A lot of people expected it. What happens now, though, is that the government appeals to the entire Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. That court, actually thanks to the nuclear option in the Senate, where they quickly filled several vacancies, is now split 7-4, Democratic appointees to Republican appointees. Most people assume that the court will take the case. They don't have to do that, but that they will, and that they will probably overturn this three-judge panel.
But there are other courts with other decisions, perhaps, and other challenges to the law that can come at any time, right? I mean, are there specific challenges we should be looking at?
Yeah, the lawsuit's based on this. These actual that, you know, that the subsidies of the federal exchange are illegal. There were four of them. Two of them, as we've now seen, have come through the courts of appeals.
The D.C.
more,
and the Richmond one.
D.C., right, and the Fourth Circuit in Richmond. There's two more cases, one in Oklahoma and one in Indiana, that are still at the district court level. So they still need to be decided by the district court and then go up to the court of appeals. So far, it looks like there won't be a split in the circuits if, as everyone predicts, where the government lost, it goes to the full appeals court, and the appeals court will, in all likelihood, overturn it. So they would have the same outcome as we saw in Richmond. Then, at that point, if someone wanted to go to the Supreme Court would not have to take the case, and the losers would probably appeal to the Supreme Court, because there's no split in the circuits, and there's a major disagreement among sort of scholars and people who are watching this about whether or not the Supreme Court would want to wade back into this. There are a lot of people who say, are you kidding? Why on earth would they want to have to actually look at the Affordable Care Act again? They just did it 2 years ago.
And they upheld it in 2012.
That's right. That's right. So then there's also the thought that why on earth would the conservatives want to take this case if Justice Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion upholding the law, was likely to uphold the law again? So there still wouldn't be five votes to do this. There are a lot of people, though, who say that, well, this is so important the Supreme Court might decide that it needs to take it up even if there isn't a split in the circuit. So even if we end up with all four appeals courts, which you could end up saying that, no, this is not a logical reading of this part of the law, you could still end up with the Supreme Court taking it. But the Supreme Court probably wouldn't have to unless one of these appeals courts ends up at the end of the day saying, yes, we think that the subsidies are illegal in federal. Now,
when we talked about the Hobby Lobby ruling, I mean, while that was significant, that was only about the contraception part of the law. If what the D.C. court ruled on, I mean, if that stood, I mean, that guts the whole purpose of the law, right, doesn't it?
Yes, it certainly makes a big mess, which, as I pointed out, is the intent to make a big mess. There's sort of three basic pieces of the additional coverage part of this law, if you take aside the Medicaid expansion, but the parts that have the exchanges in them, the idea was they were going to require insurance companies to sell to all people, sick or well, at the same price. They couldn't charge more for sick people. In exchange, those companies were going to get a lot more people to help fill out their risk pool, if you will, by two ways. One, requiring most people to either have insurance or pay this fine, and by the subsidies, because most people couldn't afford insurance without help. If you take the subsidies away, there's a provision in the law that says if the cheapest premium is more than 8% of your income, then you're not the individual mandate doesn't apply to you. So if there are no subsidies, an awful lot of people who've bought insurance would not have to buy insurance anymore, and presumably would not. Presumably the sick people who need the insurance would buy it. Premiums would become rapidly more expensive. That would be an enormous problem. The insurance industry, I'm sure today, is not as sanguine as I am about this. The other part of this is that there's an employer mandate, a requirement for large employers to either to basically provide health insurance, but that's also linked to the subsidies, because the way the employer mandate is enforced is that if you're a large employer, you don't offer coverage, and one of your employees goes to the exchange and gets a subsidy, that's what triggers the penalty. So if there's no subsidies, then there's no way to enforce the employer mandate either. So the whole thing would basically start to unravel.
Is that different than what the court ruled in 2012? I mean, when they upheld in 2012, did they talk about the subsidies the way that the D.C. court was looking at it?
No. When they upheld it in 2012, they were just looking at the individual mandate,
right,
whether that was – everyone thought that that was an exercise of the commerce power, that, you know, Congress's right to regulate health care. And instead, Chief Justice Roberts said, no, actually, it's a tax, which it is. If you don't buy health insurance, you have to pay a tax. So that was sort of how he saved it. But they did. There was very little discussion of this. The first story about this, this particular lawsuit, I did about a month after the Supreme Court ruled. It's like, oh, look, we found this glitch, and it looks like subsidies in the federal exchange might be illegal. So this has been sort of kicking around since very shortly after the Supreme Court upheld the law.
Could Roberts see that differently than he saw the mandate? I mean, or who knows, right?
Who knows? I mean, one would think that, you know, part of what Justice Roberts was doing was trying to not strike down the biggest piece of social legislation in several generations. One would assume he would make that effort this time also. And I think most legal analysts think that this case has a lot, you know, less on its merit than the case that the Supreme Court took. That was clearly a constitutional issue, whether Congress had the constitutional authority to actually impose this requirement on people. This is just statutory, you know, interpretation. Did Congress actually make a mistake, which is what most people think? It was just inartfully written, that line. And there's nothing really constitutional here. It's simply sort of what courts are called on to interpret what Congress said and what Congress meant every day.
With these circuit court challenges, or these challenges are in the courts around the country, is Congress or Republicans in Congress, are they involved in this at all? Or are they sitting back and just hoping, at least the opponents anyway, hoping something can stick?
Yeah, I think the opponents are just hoping something can stick. Although, you know, I've been sort of looking at the politics the last couple of days, and there's a lot of Republicans, I think, who are uncomfortable about this, because if the subsidies went away, that you could have, as of this moment, about almost 5 million people in those federal exchanges who have bought insurance and gotten subsidies. The subsidies are very large in most cases. They can be 70-80%. So basically, you would have almost 5 million people who would be almost immediately deprived of their insurance. That could be a real problem for Republicans if it gets pinned on them.
Wouldn't it be simpler if we just impeached the president and started all over?
There are certainly those who I've been talking to, not necessarily talking about impeachment, but saying at least for this fall, probably better for the Republicans to just run against President Obama than run against the Affordable Care Act.
I was going to say, once upon a time, the Affordable Care Act was the pathway to Republican victories in November. Maybe not any longer.
It's looking less and less like, you know, going to be the cutting issue. I think several people have said it's already baked in. The people who like it. The people who hate it, hate it. You're not going to change that many more minds. But I should also point out that there may be ways to sort of overcome this decision, even if it were to continue. There's already a lot of talk about whether states could contract with the federal government, so they would basically have, you know, an exchange on paper, but in real life it would still be the federal government, but they could sort of, you know, slip in and try to meet this requirement that Congress probably didn't mean when they wrote it.
Julie Robner is a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. She can be found on Twitter at J. Robner. Julie, it was great having you on the show.
Nice to be here.
I'm sorry we screwed up the NPR phone list. It'll never be the same. Every year, the right has its CPAC conventions and its straw polls, and it all gets a lot of media coverage. This week, it was the left's turn at the annual Netroots Nation gathering, with some progressives not quite ready for Hillary and some jumping on the Elizabeth Warren bandwagon. 3,000 activists showed up at Netroots last week in Detroit, as did Katie Glick, a reporter with Politico. Katie, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you very much for having me.
Katie, one question that I think you're not prepared for is that, why are you friends with Ben Berman and Michael Campos? Did you know that I was their baseball coach for years and they're good friends with my son?
Oh, how funny. Yeah, I was not expecting that question.
Has anybody ever asked you that question on the air before?
No, I didn't think so. We went to the same college.
Yeah, I was their baseball coach for a million years. Okay, back to the serious stuff.
Yes.
There seems to be a rapidly increasing interest in what Elizabeth Warren has to say these days. Now, I know she dismisses talk about 2016, but that hasn't stopped her supporters.
Run, 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 Liz, run. We need a president. We need President Warren, a president. We need President Warren, a president. We need President Warren.
Elizabeth Warren was there at Netroots Nation in Detroit. How was she received?
Oh, like a rock star. I mean, she was without a doubt the talk of the convention. I mean, in every single conversation that I had, her name would come up unprompted, almost universally in the context of people saying that they hoped that she would run for president, which is, of course, something that she has repeatedly ruled out. But you noted that certainly did not stop the nearly 3,000 attendees at Netroots Nation from making her really a focal point of the convention.
Did you hear anything in her voice, in her tone, anything she said that made you think that maybe she's giving 2016 some consideration?
You know, it's an interesting question. She has been hitting the trail for a number of 2014 candidates. She's been out stumping in places like West Virginia, for example.
And Kentucky, red states like Kentucky, right?
Exactly. And, you know, clearly, you know, when you see her on the stump or, again, on the stage at Netroots Nation, you know, she sounds very fired up. She really embraces this sort of image that others have of her as a fighter. You know, people see her, people on the left see her as someone who's going to really take the fight to Wall Street, take the fight to big corporations. That's certainly an image that she's embraced. But, if you ask her, and as many reporters have, you know, she is pretty adamant that this is not on the table for her right now.
You're talking about her being fired up, and you talk about her being very vocal about Wall Street. Mm-hmm. There is the inevitable comparison with Hillary Clinton. Have you
Absolutely.
Heard from your talks with people there? Have you heard people compare the two, or they like one, they don't like the other, anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. That was kind of the big story coming out of the convention. What a lot of people there said was that they really wished that Elizabeth Warren would run. But at the same time, many of them admire and respect Hillary Clinton, perhaps for some other reasons. And they also tend to see Hillary Clinton as probably the most electable Democrat out there, should she decide to run for president. But at the same time, they don't want to see a coronation, and they do want to see a contested primary on the Democratic side, whether or not Hillary Clinton runs.
If Elizabeth Warren sticks to her guns and refuses to run, do you get a sense that there's still a feeling out there, or at least at Netroots Nation, that there's a search for an alternative to Clinton, like a Bernie Sanders or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, it's important to note that Netroots Nation draws sort of the most progressive and most activist members of the Democratic base. So, of course, perhaps in other corners of the Democratic Party, you wouldn't necessarily see the same dynamic. But there, you did see a really strong appetite for some presidential contender who does hail from the left. They see Vice President Biden as coming from a bit more of a progressive perspective. Bernie Sanders was another name that came up. Governor Martin O'Malley of Maryland is someone who's certainly indicated interest in a 2016 bid. And, you know, even if many of the attendees at Netroots Nation would ultimately rally around Hillary Clinton, should she run for president, and should she become the nominee, they definitely want to see a debate playing out within the Democratic Party over issues like the role of business in the party, and sort of especially that tension between the more pro-Wall Street segments of the party and the more populist segments of the party. They kind of want to have that conversation played out in a big way.
Now, you mentioned Joe Biden. I just looked him up. He is the vice president of the United States. I just looked that up.
No, I'm kidding,
of course, because not many people talk about him about 2016. But he was at Netroots Nation. How did he fare? What was the reaction he got?
He went over well. He was introduced by a prominent progressive activist who introduced him and sort of thanked him for pushing, you know, as they saw it, at least publicly pushing the White House to come out in support of same-sex marriage.
He beat the president on that one, didn't he?
He sure did, at least in terms of his public announcement of support for it. So he was very well received, especially when he talked about gay rights issues.
Of course, Hillary Clinton did not attend Netroots Nation. I know you said that there is certainly support for her and understanding for her, but would she have gotten the kind of reception that that Elizabeth Warren got, do you think?
I'm not sure anyone would have gotten the kind of reception that Elizabeth Warren got, at least at this stage, just kind of given who the crowd was, given just how progressive this crowd was, and how angry many attendees there were with Wall Street. And they really see Elizabeth Warren, of course, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts, as giving voice to that frustration with Wall Street in a way that few others do. And again, you know, many people there certainly said that they respect Hillary Clinton. They would like to see the first woman president, and, you know, they see her as having a good chance at fulfilling that role. But, you know, at this point, just in terms of, you know, the people that they are most excited about, or, you know, who they hope might run, and they really see Elizabeth Warren as most speaking to their most pressing concerns.
Katie Glick is a political reporter for Politico. She can be found on Twitter at Katie_Glick. That's GLUECK. Katie_Glick, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And please give my best to Ben Berman and Michael Campos.
I certainly will.
Thanks, Katie.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Next on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Hey, that's me. We go back in time to 1981, a time of Betty Davis's eyes, John McEnroe, the Yankees versus Dodgers, and bipartisan budgets? Did I say bipartisan? We talked to one of the 48 House Democrats who crossed party lines to vote for Ronald Reagan's tax cuts. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie. It's time for This Week in Political History. The year is 1981. President Reagan is fairly new to the White House. The Democrats hold a big numbers advantage in the House. And yet, 6 months into his term, he pushes Congress to pass an across-the-board tax cut as part of a package that cuts $35 billion from the budget. It's called the most far-reaching change in fiscal policy since the New Deal. And Ronald Reagan being Ronald Reagan, he went in front of the American people in a TV address 2 days before the vote, telling them the choice is clear.
In a few days, the Congress will stand at the fork of two roads. One road is all too familiar to us. It leads ultimately to higher taxes. It merely brings us full circle back to the source of our economic problems, where the government decides that it knows better than you what should be done with your earnings, and in fact how you should conduct your life. The other road promises to renew the American spirit. It's a road of hope and opportunity. It places the direction of your life back in your hands where it belongs.
The pressure on Congress after Reagan's speech was enormous. 48 Democrats in the Democratic-controlled House broke with their party to vote for the tax cuts. The measure passed. One of the Democrats who voted with Reagan on the tax cuts was Don Fuquay of Florida. Congressman Fuquay, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Ken.
Congressman, let me go back to 1981 for a bit. You'd been in Congress for nearly 20 years, representing a conservative but Democratic district in northern Florida around Tallahassee. You rarely ever faced a Republican challenger, and when you did, you still got 70 to 80% of the vote. Jimmy Carter carried your district twice, including 1980 over Reagan, and you were part of the Democratic leadership in the House, a deputy whip. And here you are, faced with which way to vote on President Reagan's tax cuts. So tell me, what was going on in the country at the time? What made you decide your vote?
Well, we were having some very high inflation, And the economy was a big issue with when Reagan defeated Carter. And he had proposed this massive cut, and I had serious questions about it. But the president, to his credit, had sold the American people, and a lot of people, influential people in my district that I had respect for and didn't have that I was aware of a particular political axe to grind, were encouraging me to support it. And I reluctantly did at the last minute, thought that maybe, you know, we needed to change directions. But I voted for this reluctantly and later realized that it was probably one of the worst votes I ever cast while I was in Congress.
Well, at the time of the vote, I mean, I was about to say, did you get emails? There was no email back then, but were there phone calls? Were there letters? Were you contacted by the president himself?
Well, I was contacted by Donald Regan, who was Secretary of the Treasury. I remember I was in Florida, and he called me, and we discussed it. And I made no commitment to support it at that time. And then the president called. But I was inquiring among some of my friends that were business people and good supporters. And they were encouraging me. Chambers of Commerce and civic leaders in the community were encouraging me to support it. Let's give it a try. And I felt, well, you know, I do represent the people, and I probably need to follow kind of what the will of the people is, if that's you know, consistent with what I normally believe in. And I did reluctantly agree that to go ahead and vote for it. And parenthetically, later, Reagan said, you know, his feet was in concrete, and he later came along and asked for some tax increases, and he said, you can hear the concrete cracking around my feet.
What kind was there? I mean, you talk about the pressure from the White House, the pressure from Donald Regan. Was there pressure from your own party leadership, Speaker Tip O'Neill? Did they?
And I were very good friends, and I talked to Tip about this, and he, of course, he made himself clear that, you know, he would like for me to vote for it. But I said, you know, I'm very concerned about this. I think maybe we need to go ahead. And I think Tip at that time had already read the handwriting on the wall that the president probably had the votes to pass it.
How important do you think was President Reagan's televised appeal 2 days before the congressional vote?
Well, he was very good at those things. America under Carter had begun to feel like, you know, that we had lost our mojo. And Reagan was one that I think made people want to feel good about themselves and feel good about their country. And he was a very persuasive speech maker, as I think is tested in things that he did and the way he approached the American people.
You pointed out that, of course, Reagan called for the tax cuts in 81, and then there were tax increases in 82. And you also mentioned there was a vote that you regretted. Did constituents come back to you and said you made the wrong move, or you just realized at some point that maybe it wasn't the right vote?
I realized myself that later on that was not a very good vote, and I thought it probably was one of the worst votes I'd ever cast while I'd been in Congress.
From your perch in northern Florida, can you compare the presidential leadership styles of Reagan and President Obama?
Well, I have been somewhat disappointed in President Obama. I think Reagan would invite the leaders of the House down to the White House, or leaders of Congress down to the White House for a social, no agenda. We would stand around and talk, and then he and Tip O'Neill would start telling Irish stories. Mm-hmm. And your ribs would hurt from laughing. And there were both Republicans and Democrats there, and the president schmoozed members of Congress. I'm not sure that this president is doing that, and I think he's missing a golden opportunity, not just occasionally go play golf with the speaker, but to try to get to know the people. After all, he was not in the Senate very long before he was elected president, and I supported him. But I think, you know, he has really missed a good boat here by not being more familiar with the members of Congress and how they work and willing to work with them on trying to resolve differences, just like Tip O'Neill and Reagan did on the Social Security fix that they came up with, and it passed.
Don Fuquay served 24 years in the House from Florida's 2nd Congressional District, rising to become chairman of the Science and Technology Committee. He retired in 1986. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ken.
It was on this week in 1981 that Congress, including the Democratic-controlled House, passed tax cuts urged on by President Ronald Reagan, the largest tax cuts in the nation's history. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. Coming up on The Political Junkie, we break down the results in Georgia's Republican Senate runoff and look ahead to the upcoming gubernatorial race in Kansas. I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie. You're listening to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of the last trivia question, which was, who was the last Supreme Court justice who, after leaving the court, ran for political office? The answer is Arthur Goldberg. President Lyndon Johnson convinced him to leave the court in 1965 so he could appoint his pal, Abe Fortas, in his stead. He made Goldberg ambassador to the United Nations, which was hardly a fair trade. Anyway, in 1970, Goldberg ran for governor of New York, but lost to the incumbent Republican, Nelson Rockefeller. And the winner is Tom Reinstein of Rochester, New York. Tom gets the Political Junkie button. And the most recent Scuttle Button puzzle? An Arch Moore for Governor button from West Virginia. One that says, the Duke makes me puke. Another one says, it's Sinatra's world, we just live in it. Then a picture button from the Philippines that says, Loyalist for Marcos. Ferdinand Marcos was the country's president until his ouster in 1986. Now, not everyone was happy with this puzzle. With the Sinatra button, I was thinking of his real first name, Francis. And thus, Archmore plus Duke plus Francis plus Ferdinand led me to Archduke Franz Ferdinand, that guy whose assassination led to some war. I don't know, something like that. Anyway, on second review, maybe the Sinatra button was not the way to go. I guess I could have done a better job, but I did it my way.
For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not.
Still, fair is fair, and a button prize has to be delivered, crummy puzzle or not. And the button goes to Earl Hunt of Austin, Texas. You can keep up with the latest scuttlebutt puzzles, trivia, and political yakking at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And now, on the road to campaign 2014, we head first to Georgia, where on Tuesday, Republicans picked their nominee for the Senate seat being vacated by two-term incumbent Saxby Chambliss. David Perdue, a businessman and first-time candidate, narrowly defeated Congressman Jack Kingston in the primary runoff. He now faces Democrat Michelle Nunn, a political newcomer, who's running as a centrist and has been leading her Republican rivals in the polls for months. Jim Galloway has spent three decades with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and founded the Political Insider blog and column. Jim, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Great to be here.
Okay, so Perdue is his first-time candidate. He beats Kingston, who's been a congressman for two decades.
Right.
It was close, but he beat him. In your column, how did you explain how it happened?
First, you have to kind of set it up there. I mean, Kingston pretty much had the support of every elected Republican that I can think of. Maybe one or two state lawmakers were backing Perdue for personal reasons. So you had the weight of the Republican establishment on that one side, and plus you also had the fact that that Perdue, when he made the runoff, he basically knocked out two congressmen and a former Secretary of State, and he said three down, one to go. It was kind of a declaration of war. Hmm. So we truly expected the heft of the GOP to come down on Perdue, and by gosh, the guy pulled it out.
D- Do we know what he did? I mean, Kingston always seemed to be this nice, friendly kind of guy. And I know that Perdue said some things about, you talk about the former Secretary of State, Karen Handel, who basically, I mean, was backing Kingston because she didn't like the way she was treated by Perdue in the primary. It seemed
Yeah. He called her out on a high school education. But what happened, you had two things. Number one, you know, you had some nuts and bolts stuff going. You had Kingston got into the runoff because he's down on the coast of Georgia. That's not where the population of center of Georgia
down
is.
Down by Savannah, right?
Right, right. And he's from Savannah, and the population center is kind of north of the Macon, the middle of the state. And so, but he ran up the score in the May 20th primary, pulled out 74% in his congressional district, and it got him into the runoff. He couldn't repeat that. He didn't repeat that last night. And that got him. But what was probably the more interesting thing is what ended up happening was the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, got involved in this race. All right. Now, you would expect the Chamber of Commerce to back the former CEO of Dollar General rather than the guy, the congressman who opposes immigration reform and who is anti-Common Core. Right.
Okay.
But no. No, the chamber backed Jack Kingston, poured $2.3 million into the runoff to tide him over a little bit.
Now the Chamber of Commerce is known to be supporting immigration legislation.
Yeah,
so that kind of
exactly.
So that backfired on Kingston?
Yeah, so what happened was Perdue did a little jujitsu, and his last barrage of ads were kind of questioned. He said, basically raising the point that, look, the Chamber of Commerce is backing Jack Kingston. But Jack Kingston says he's against immigration reform. Somebody's not telling the truth. So he was able to really cast some doubt on Kingston's veracity.
How bad was it for Kingston to be a member of Congress?
You know, I think that was the killer. I really do. I mean, 7% approval rating? How do you – I mean, and I got to say, I think Michelle Nunn, the Democrat in the race that's waiting on the other side, I think she probably would have preferred to have met Kingston.
Yeah, here's some of the issues that Perdue ran against Kingston in one of his ads.
So what did desperate Jack Kingston do? What all politicians do. He lashed out falsely at David Perdue. The truth is, David Perdue has saved and created thousands of jobs. We don't need more Washington. We need a conservative outsider.
So there's something to be said about a candidate who doesn't have to defend a voting record in Congress, and perhaps Michelle Nunn did not get the candidate she would have preferred to run against.
Right, right. And now what you have is you have Michelle Nunn, who has never held office, David Perdue, who has never held office. And I'll tell you what, the Libertarian in the race is by far the most of the trio, the most experienced politician. She used to serve on the Flowery Branch City Council in Georgia.
I remember with the Saxby-Chambliss race that because of a third-party candidate, it was thrown into a runoff. Is that a possibility with this race?
Oh, absolutely. It's a possibility, and we've had some really hinky election laws passed since then. See, we've got a Libertarian in the gubernatorial race, too. And if that race for governor goes into a runoff, that runoff would be held in December. But the federal one, because it has to obey some U.S. Justice Department guidelines, that can't be held until January 6th.
So we may.
It would span Christmas and New Year's.
So we may not, theoretically, we may not know who controls the Senate until January 6th?
I wouldn't say it's highly possible, but it is definitely possible.
We keep talking about how demographics in Georgia are changing, and they may not be changing as fast as some Democrats would like, but theoretically, with African-American population surging and Latino and other populations surging, it's fair to say Michelle Nunn certainly has a chance.
She certainly does. And when you throw Jason Carter into the mix, the grandson of the former president running for governor, together they're pouring enough money in this in this state that can make something happen. But I think what you have to do is you have to think of this as more of a three-cycle, six-year effort. The real effort is to capture the governorship in 2018. That's the redistricting governorship. That's when right after 2018 we have the 2020 census coming out. That's when redistricting comes out. That's in every state. That's the most important event, political event.
There were also some House runoffs as well on Tuesday, and I think the one that probably got most attention was in the 11th District, where former Congressman Bob Barr was seeking a comeback. Bob Barr didn't fare too well.
No, he did not. That was a stunning rejection of a former congressman, of a fellow who used to be very, very popular in here. I think it was a 3-1 margin. He was defeated by State Senator Barry Loudermilk, very much a Tea Party candidate. But I think what you have to remember is the 11th District. It starts as a smidge in Atlanta, but shoots up through Northwest Georgia. That's old. That's real John Birch territory up there.
Okay. I mean, I know this is just July, and of course, the Republican Party does need to unite, and we have to see if and how Michelle Nunn adjusts her campaign. But right now, where do you see the race right now for the Senate?
Oh, boy, you're really putting the pressure on here. If David Perdue can make a real dent in getting white suburban women of North Metro Atlanta, I think he's got a pretty darn good chance of carrying the day. If Michelle Nunn makes inroads there, I think that's a danger. The other portion of that is African-American turnout. Of course, you know, we know it sometimes it dips, but it's been pretty darn steady. So it's been 28-30% and climbing each cycle. If there is an effort in this state, and I've talked to Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed about this, and he's very, very big on this. The Barack Obama model is that you go out and you find the African-American and Hispanic voters who have not bothered to sign up and register. You go out and find them, and it's an expensive process, but it can pay off. He says if Carter and Nunn do that, then they've got a chance of making their way to victory in November.
Isn't that funny when you say you're talking about Georgia and saying Carter and Nunn? It sounds like we're back in the 1970s again.
Isn't it? Well, we've got three legacy candidates now, because David Perdue is the cousin of former Governor Sonny Perdue, who was the first Republican governor elected in 2002.
And Bob Barr was, of course, related to that song by the Beach Boys, right? Bob Barr. Right. Jim, thanks so much. Jim,
no, I enjoyed it. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Jim Galloway is a veteran political reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I really appreciate it, Jim. Thanks a lot. We'll get you on the show again.
All right. We'll see you. Take care.
Thanks. And now we travel to Kansas, where the joke has long been there are two political parties there, conservative Republicans and very conservative Republicans. And the battle between the two wings increased last week when the state's Republican governor, Sam Brownback, got some bad news. More than 100 former and current Republican officials endorsed Brownback's Democratic opponent, Paul Davis, the state House minority leader. Brownback has spent much of his first term trying to push out so-called moderate Republicans from the legislature, backing conservative challengers in the primary. Now it looks like it's a revenge of the center. Steve Kraske teaches journalism at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, writes a column for the Kansas City Star, and hosts a show on the public radio station KCUR called Up to Date. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Ken, it's always good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, now bring us up to date with what's going on with Governor Brownback.
Well, it's a remarkable story, Ken. You know, when he was elected in 2010, moving into 2011 and even the early stages of 2012, he was simply untouchable politically out here. Very, very powerful governor who was working actively to reshape the legislature in his own conservative image by, you know, campaigning for conservatives both in the House and the Senate. And he really had set himself up to be in an incredibly strong position as he hit the midpoint of his first term.
He left the Senate to run for governor, right?
He left the U.S. Senate after 2.5 terms to come out here and be the governor, you bet. Things have really flipped for him, Ken, as you look at the landscape out here. A whole series of news events in the last year or so just haven't played very well to his advantage. Any number of things. State revenues plunging in the wake of these very large tax cuts, income tax cuts that he implemented about 18 months ago. Latest stories, we ended the fiscal year here at the end of June, $338 million below estimates, at least out here in Kansas, Ken. That's real money.
And the credit rating has been downgraded as well, right?
The credit rating has been downgraded. You throw in an FBI investigation of some of his closest campaign aides, not his administration, but his campaign aides out in Topeka. And you have a cloud over him now that certainly we haven't seen a governor have to face out here in Kansas for a long time. We usually let our FBI investigations take place on the Missouri side of the state line. Haven't seen this kind of thing in Kansas in many years, but we have one going on right now.
Well, the stuff that's going on with Brownback, I mean, is it the state finances, or is it more about this ongoing civil war that we were talking about?
Well, I think it's a combination of everything, Ken. I mean, certainly you have a lot of folks now around the state who are looking at all this, even Republicans, and who are saying to themselves and telling folks like me, things just don't feel right in Topeka. The press obviously has been very critical, really all around the state, even in Republican rural areas of Kansas. They've been very critical of the direction Governor Brownback has taken. And when you see revenues dropping off the table by $338 million, a lot of folks out here who care about public education, who care about higher education, who are very concerned about social services and the state's reputation along those lines, have grown to be very concerned about the direction the state's headed in.
Now, before we go on, it's fair to say that Kansas is a deep red state. It doesn't vote for Democratic presidential candidates. I think none since Lyndon Johnson. There's been no Democratic Senate elected since 1932.
Longest stretch in the country.
Right, you and I were just kids back then. But but it does elect Democrats to the governorship from time to time.
It's remarkable, Ken. Despite that picture you just painted, Democrats do win the governorship, obviously the state's highest office, and they win the governorship with some regularity. You go back 30, 35 years in Kansas, Democrats have held the office almost as often, or very much as often as Republicans have. There's been no differentiation here between the parties in terms of who's controlled the governor's office. Obviously, most recently, the Democratic governor, we had Kathleen Sebelius out here, who went on to be Health and Human Services Secretary under President Obama, but a very steady track record of electing Democrats to this office.
Who are these Republicans who've bolted from Brownback? Are they just those who were purged by the governor, or is it just, you know, people who are just watching the finances? Who are these Republicans?
It's folks who have been purged. It's folks who are concerned about finances. It's folks who are moderate Republicans, Ken. And as much as any state in the country, I think it's fair to say that Kansas really does have three political parties these days: the conservative Republicans, the moderate Republicans who have traditionally run the state in the image of Nancy Kassebaum and Bob Dole, and then of course you have your Democrats on the other side. But no question that the moderates, now 100 of them, more than 100, have lined up in a very strong display of dissatisfaction with the governor from their own party. Just a couple of weeks ago, they filed single-handedly onto a stage in Topeka and declared their allegiance to Paul Davis, the Democratic candidate. Extremely unusual move in a state like this. These are lifelong Republicans, loath to back a Democrat, and yet more than 100 did so, and did so very publicly just a couple weeks ago here.
Given the dissatisfaction among these moderates with Brownback, why isn't there a challenge to him in the August 5th primary?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's fair to say that no one really viewed him as vulnerable until maybe a year ago, 10 months ago. That would have put someone in a tough position to put together a campaign to defeat Governor Brownback. You know, he still is very strong with the conservative wing. It's the conservatives who turn out in primaries and nominate Republican candidates for governor. Beating Brownback in a primary would have been very difficult. And then obviously, as you know better than anybody can, you throw in the financial advantage that Governor Brownback has in terms of money raised, and beating him in a primary would have been tough, if not next to impossible.
Since he was elected governor in 2010, he's been basically governing from the far right, at least for a lot of his term. What are the how does one, somebody like that, pivot to the center to win over enough votes to get reelected if there is problems within his own party?
Great question. It's been interesting to watch him of late. You see him beginning to make a few moves when it comes to talking about social services and reaching a handout to our most vulnerable citizens through one program or another. He's made a couple of moves that way that might begin to broaden appeal. But I would suggest at this point that Governor Brownback's image is so deeply embedded in the state, not just from his nearly 4 years as governor, but also for his, well, I think it's 15, 16 years as a U.S. senator. Kansans know Governor Brownback. They know him to be a very strong conservative. To see him become anything other than that, I think would begin to look disingenuous. And I'm willing to bet you that Brownback's aides know exactly that.
Steve Kraske is the host of Up to Date on KCUR in Kansas City. Steve, it was great having you on the show again.
Ken, I sure appreciate it. All the best to you.
I just want to take this time to thank all the wonderful people in Fairbanks, Alaska, who made the Political Junkie road trip with Neil Conan and Ken Rudin a great success. A special thanks to Michelle Bartlett, who's the head of the summer sessions at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. She was fantastic. Her staff was amazing. There's also Lori Neufeld of KUAC, the member station of Fairbanks. She was tremendous as well. And I really appreciate everything they did for us. You can hear the Alaska special on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. And for all those people who were trying to drive to Alaska but couldn't because their car ran out of gas, well, if you're still stuck in someplace like Aspen, Colorado, on Saturday, August 9th at the 3rd Street Center in Carbondale, Colorado, not far from Aspen, I will be there yakking away and doing scuttlebutt puzzles and all that fun stuff, courtesy of Aspen Public Radio. Again, for details, check our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. If your car did run out of gas, take to Aspen and call me in the morning. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Want to catch the podcast? You can subscribe on iTunes, add us to your Stitcher playlist, and track us down on TuneIn Radio. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttlebutt puzzles, you can visit us on the web at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash... oh, God, I need the cash. To Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster. Kristen Sorensen is our consultant. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.